You're first, Mr. Kutry, huh?
That's right, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Gianni Kutry on behalf of the appellant, Tavis Doyle, and my co-counsel, Leslie Schmidt, will be arguing on rebuttal. Mr. Doyle is appealing his conviction on count four pertaining to the alleged distribution of heroin that allegedly caused the death of Jonathan Ward.
Mr. Kutry, I want to ask you a rude question about that.
Sure.
As I understand your appeal, Mr. Doyle is not challenging the, was it 60-year sentence on count two?
That's right.
And he's okay with that?
Well,
you all confirmed with him that he does not want to appeal anything except the life sentence.
Your Honor, the issue here, I don't want to get into too much of the what might have been a privileged conversation with Mr. Doyle, but
I don't want content. I just want to know,
is that he is okay with that. That's our understanding, yes.
Okay.
It's a threshold issue, obviously, because even if he were to succeed with respect to count two, he still has the life sentence on count four. If we overturn on count four, he at least has the potential to go back and argue for different sentencing with respect to count one or count two, maybe with the development of additional evidence. But we had been aware of that issue.
Okay.
But in any event, with respect to count four, our principal argument here is that Mr. Doyle's Sixth Amendment right to confront his accusers was denied when the government failed to produce the author or authors of the autopsy report, which is Exhibit 95F. Mr. Doyle's Sixth Amendment right was likewise denied when he was by way of the government's obstruction of Mr. Conclair's cross-examination, as well as the government's improper coaching.
Both Dr. Birch and Dr. Long were available to talk about heroin versus cocaine as a cause of death. Doesn't that undercut the notion that you were prejudiced by the inability to cross-examine Dr. Dutra?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, and it's when you understand the context of Exhibit 95F.
By the way, are you holding Exhibit 95F?
I am.
Where do we find that in the record, and why is it not in the appendix?
I apologize, Your Honor. It was not in the appendix. We can make it available. I'm happy to give you my copy right
here. Just tell me where to find it. We've looked in the record and haven't found it.
Yeah. Oh, it's – I know it's – it was admitted – I know it was admitted at trial, and I think it's part of the trial record, but we can – we can certainly make that available.
Well, it's the centerpiece of the
I understand that, Your Honor, and I'm happy to hand this up if that's helpful. I'll refer to it, I think, during our argument here. 95F is the St. Louis Medical Examiner's
Sure.
Office.
It's the preliminary findings form.
Well, it doesn't say preliminary findings form.
But it is that.
Is it not? No, our position is that this document is the only document in the record. What this is the assistant medical examiner's, Dr. Dutra's record, his handwritten notes of his observations of the external examination of Mr. Ward's body. Dr. Dutra made these by himself.
Help me with this.
Sure.
Is a cross out on a form testimonial in nature?
In this case, absolutely. We know from Bullcoming that even the blank on a form can be testimonial. But here's the cross-out on this form. Acute heroin and cocaine intoxication was what was written originally. And we can presume that that was written by Dr. Dutra, right? The government represents in its brief that this form is somehow Dr. Birch's work, but it's really not. Dr. Birch testified as follows. This is the question. What is crossed out here, and what is crossed out here, and what is crossed out here? Would that have been crossed out by you, or would that have been crossed out by Dr. Dutra? They're asking Dr. Birch. It was not crossed out by me, is his answer. Okay. I don't cross such things out. Question, why not? If I want to indicate that I don't approve of something, I put a line through it so you can still clearly read it.
He was competent, of course, to testify about the postmortem examination, was he not?
We don't believe that he's competent to testify as to what Dr. Dutra concluded with respect to the postmortem.
Well, is he competent to testify about the final official findings as to the cause of death?
We believe that his competence.
The question is capable of a yes or no answer. Was he competent to make that finding?
No, we do not believe that he's competent because his opinion rests on this document, which the government admitted into the used to support his conviction.
Well, did the defense really ever even challenge heroin overdose as the cause of death?
What the defense needed to do so, however, was Dr. Dutra's testimony.
Well,
Dr. Dutra.
Did the defense try to subpoena him? I don't think so.
Right? That's true, Your Honor.
And let me follow up on that a little bit, because the concern I have, we have to review this under essentially a plain error standard, because no objection of the kind was raised at the time. And this is the kind of objection which, if raised, could have been addressed by bringing Dutra in, right?
Potentially. We don't know for sure.
The government has nationwide subpoena powers. The court has nationwide subpoena powers for criminal cases. That could have been done. And so I'm troubled by the idea that it would be plain error. There are a lot of reasons why hearsay objections that could be made are not made. It happens every few minutes in a trial sometimes. And if we were to agree, if we were to hold that it's plain error for the district judge not to have raised the hearsay confrontation clause issue himself, then we throw a lot of sand in the gears of trials by forcing judges to raise objections that nobody really cares about. In fact, the defense might prefer not to have Dutra there in person.
I've read that suggestion in the government's brief, and we strenuously disagree. The way this document was admitted was that Dr. Birch, the government said, Dr. Birch, this is your work, and these are your conclusions. And Dr. Birch, with some leading questions on direct, suggested as much. It wasn't until the cross-examination, when the pointed questions that I was just reading were asked, that Dr. Birch admits, well, in fact, this isn't my testimony.
Okay, but there's no motion to strike, right?
There is no motion to strike, but on that point, Your Honor, what we rely on is a passage in Melendez-Diaz which says the following. The Confrontation Clause imposes a burden on the prosecution to present its witnesses, not on the defendant to bring those adverse witnesses into court.
Of course, you were able to cross-examine Dr. Long once the toxicology results were available.
Well, Dr. Long was not a substitute for Dr. Dutra. I'll finish this. Dr. Dutra concluded that cocaine was a cause of death. Someone crossed that out. It wasn't there's no suggestion in the record that it was Dr. Long, and we don't know who crossed that document out, that crossed that reference out. Footnote 9 of the government's brief says there is nothing in the record showing that Dr. Dutra was the person who crossed out the records. This is mere speculation. So with respect to using Dr. Long, Dr. Long is a toxicologist, and he deferred to Dr. Birch. So he's not a sufficient substitute. But
in Melendez-Diaz, the defense objected, correct?
I believe that's correct.
I mean, the fact that the defense could have also called in the doctor was not sufficient to cure a timely objection, right? That's the problem in Melendez-Diaz?
That's right.
Okay. What we've got here is very different. What we've got here is the potential for a trap.
I see that, Your Honor, but I would submit that the trap is not the fault of the defendant here. This is not a situation where the defendant sees this document
and says... Why it might be. When the government offered the final postmortem report into evidence, isn't it so that Doyle's counsel volunteered that he had no objection to any of the other medical documents, which, of course, would include 95F, which is what is being complained about here.
This stack, and this is the entire stack of documents, was offered at the same time. What happened was this. This is the representation by the government. These all come in at the same time. Let's turn then to the records, and he's talking to Dr. Birch. Let's turn then to the records that do reflect the results of your work and some of the means by which you were able to arrive at certain conclusions. This is before we find out on cross-examination that this isn't Dr. Birch's work. And it goes to your point, Your Honor, about why didn't you just subpoena the person? It's because it's not until you find out on cross-examination that the government's representation is less than accurate. And Dr. Birch has been hoping because Dr. Dutcher isn't available, has been hoping that he can sponsor and put this document in. So this isn't a situation by any stretch where the government suggests that, well, we were just laying in waiting trying to create this trap and we were better off with Dr. Dutcher without Dr. Dutcher's testimony. If Dr. Dutcher writes down that cocaine intoxication is the cause of death, we're much better off having him in court. And that's our position. That's our position here today. I think the most you could say about the failure rate objection was it was an oversight.
On that theory, though, 95F is exculpatory, and it's evidence the defendant should have been clamoring to put in, right?
If 95F doesn't have the cross out, it's exculpatory. That's the issue. Someone crossed this out, and we don't know who that is. So the government gets the upside of having the cross out, and we get the downside of not being able to get the original person who put cocaine intoxication in. So it's really the government putting this document in this posture and trying to suggest, and by that point, the jury's heard Dr. Birch say it's his document. With respect to the issues on this point, at the end of the day, the government ultimately just wants to suggest, as Your Honor's question suggested, that, well, if Dr. Dutcher were made available, he would have supported the government's case. There's really no debate about that. But that's not necessarily true, and in any event...
No, that's not true, but the problem is the plain error standard of review.
Well, we can establish that if Dr. Dutcher were made available, the outcome would have been would have been different.
How do you do
if
that?
If Dr. Dutcher comes to stand and says, this is my document, I wrote cocaine intoxication...
Has anybody checked with him?
What's that?
Has anybody checked with him?
Have they since? We have not, but we're happy to do that and submit the additional briefing. But on the record we have here, if he comes in and says, this is my submission, and I have and I wrote cocaine down here, and I maintain that cocaine was a cause of death, now you have two witnesses on the government side of the case, two medical examiners, one saying heroin and heroin alone, that's Dr. Birch, and the other, Dr. Dutcher, saying heroin and cocaine.
Can I ask you about a second issue?
Sure.
Regarding the cross-examination of Klinker?
Yes.
Which became so controversial. The government makes the point in its response brief that after the blow-up, the district judge's admonition and threats to the prosecutor, the defense had the opportunity to ask, by their count, 175 questions of Klinker. Why doesn't that essentially resolve this problem?
Because what the government never takes on is our point about the key questions that were objected to. What the government tries to say is, well, we didn't object to most of them, so that somehow you can just round up from 98%.
Not just most. I mean, there were 513 objections.
That's right.
But 10 were over.
The key 10 objections, and let me give you one example. The main issue with Mr. Klinker is he was coached by the government. That was our contention at trial. And if you look at where that testimony is coming in, I can give you the site, but where that testimony is coming in, the defense counsel has established with Mr. Klinker, you met with the government 12 times. You met with them yesterday. You met with them this morning. And they talked to you about this case, right? And they talked to you about what to say, right? And what did they say? Objection, Your Honor. Who's they? That becomes the government's objection at that point. And what our point is, you can obstruct a cross-examination by waiting for the key question to come up. Skilled trial practitioners know when the key question's coming, and that's how you can obstruct the cross-examination.
And skilled opponents keep the question in mind, and after the objection is overruled, go back to it and take advantage of the overruled objection.
But at a certain point, when it's screaming objections and it's speaking objections and it's so disruptive that even the court has to make a representation, we intrude on the right to a fair trial. And I'm completely out of time, but thank you, Your Honor. We ask that the conviction be reversed as accountable.
And I should add, despite my complaint about the exhibit not being in the appendix, I did appreciate the effective reproduction of the key portions in your brief.
And we apologize for that, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court?
Yeah. Mr. McGrath, forgive me.
May it please the court. I am Tom McGrath, representing the United States. I want to start with clearing up a couple of things. First, in the reply brief and at here, counsel continued to call the findings form the autopsy report. I just want to point out that there was a postmortem examination report signed by Dr. Birch that was in the record at 95B. There were the pathological findings at 95C. There was the micro-slide exam, and that was also signed by Dr. Birch. The micro-slide examination, 95D, signed by Dr. Birch, and the toxicology report, 95E, signed by Dr. Birch. These all made up the autopsy report and the report that was put in.
Well, for what reason did you offer 95F if it was merely a set of preliminary findings?
Well, Your Honor, first, it was part of the record. It was part of the entire thing. Second, I believe it was because if we're not going to bring this document in, the other side is, because there is the line about cocaine in there. And I think that the thinking was, let's get it out ahead, let's put it out there, let's discuss it, let's talk about it, and then everything is there. So there's no ambiguity. It is part of the record, and they wanted to have it in. So they put it in as that.
But there's a lot of ambiguity, isn't there?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Who crossed it out?
There's ambiguity on who crossed it out. I think that it's likely that it was Dr. Dutra, but we don't have that on the record. But I think that the ambiguity comes from the fact that this was a preliminary findings. This is what they found out first. And then once they have other information, they fix it. So I wanted to start first with a waiver argument a little bit, because both Bullcoming and Melendez-Diaz talk about waiver if you don't object. They also talk about waiver if you stipulate. And in this case, we have almost both. We have they didn't object, and then when the opportunity came, when the government was going through one by one, setting the foundation for each of these documents, Mr. Doyle's counsel got up and said, we'll let them all in. It's incorrect to say that we introduced all the documents at once. We handed them all to the doctor at once to go through one by one, but it wasn't into evidence until the volunteer from the other side. So we think that that covers both that there was no objection made and that there was an effective stipulation, if not a real stipulation.
Now, the defense response to that, as I understand it as well, of course he reasonably agreed to that, but he was relying on what Dr. Birch was saying about his role with respect to those documents, and then turns out later on cross-examination that Birch really can't provide much of an explanation here about 95F.
Well, Dr. Birch couldn't explain why they were crossed off, but he was there for the autopsy. He was there when they were going through the findings. They didn't
right,
do
but
this.
In terms, I'm talking about your waiver point here.
Right.
Though, and which is, I guess, troubling to me. In the defense argument on that seems pretty reasonable.
Well, I think they overplay what Dr. Birch said before that. There was no trick to get this in. Dr. Birch said these are the documents that the medical examiner's office looked at and used and relied upon.
It doesn't have to be a trick, but in terms
right.
of what he can individually testify to.
Right, but I think if you look at the full record, that doesn't seem that they made that decision that, oh, 95F, he must have, I mean, it was signed by Dr. Dutra on the bottom. I also want to talk a little bit about the fact that we think it's strategic, because there are two outcomes here. First, either 95F doesn't come in if they make the objection, and then Dr. Birch can rely on the fact that he was there for the autopsy. He has his postmortem report. He wrote the pathological findings, which says acute intoxication of heroin on it, and he has all these documents to rely on. If the case was that Dr. Birch said, the only reason we put acute heroin in here is because I looked at 95F and saw that it says acute heroin and cocaine was crossed out, there might be a point here, but that's not what happened here. Dr. Birch was part of the process. He supervised and he looked over the entire thing, and it was his opinion that was put in. So I think that the idea was if it doesn't come in, then they are even stronger and the ambiguity doesn't exist. So it's strategic to get it in and not object to it. I don't think they needed this 95F to make their point. So I want to also talk about the fact that this is not testimonial. This is not a solemn declaration. It's not created to establish or prove a fact. It is the preliminary findings that by the form itself says is tentative and based on toxicology.
I don't understand that argument. I understand it may go to its weight, but I don't understand how it's not testimonial.
Well, I look to both the point of a solemn declaration. It seems odd to me to solemnly declare that this is what we think that might be changed later based on more information, but for now this is what we think. I also look to establishing or proving a fact when they say in the form that this is the toxicology report may change this.
if I'm recalling the cases correctly, say an hour after a domestic violence encounter occurs, a statement is made to a police officer that's later recanted. We treat that kind of statement as testimonial, right?
I believe that, but that was at the time was a statement of sure fact, and then it was later recanted. And this, it was a tentative. Well, they're saying in the document, we need more information before we put forward a report. I think that the final postmortem report is what would be testimonial in this case.
So you think, so suppose the final postmortem, well, never mind, go ahead. Let me, if I could, move ahead to one point. This is not the principal focus of the defense brief, but it's troubling to me. It seems that the government witnesses offered a number of different accounts as to how Mr. Ward wound up ingesting the heroin that the government contends killed him. Can you tell us the government's theory as to when he ingested that cocaine, who he got it from, and who was with him when it happened?
It's the government's theory that on the day Mr. Doyle and Mr. Ward went out to get drugs together. When they came back, they went into the back bedroom together where we believe that's where the heroin was taken. This was around, we believe, around 7 p.m. at night.
With nobody else around.
With nobody else around when the heroin was taken. When Mr. Klinkar walked in and when Ms. Blankenship walked in, they found Mr. Ward on the ground with the heroin next to him. So it was behind closed doors, as most times when someone is taking heroin is. The fact that there were different accounts of the time mostly goes to the fact that these were people that were taking heroin, that they were in this drug house the entire day, and there are going to be different accounts. The government put it all out there, the jury heard all of it, and they found who was credible, and they put it down. So, yes, were there some differences in timing? Of course there was. But the jury heard it all, and the jury made their decision. Talk a little bit about the Klinkar testimony and the 513 questions. As was pointed out here, 513 questions were asked, and they were answered. You can't obstruct just by making an objection. If you could, then the fact that you have to make these split-second decisions on when you're going to object to something would become much more onerous on the objector. There's no case law that says just merely by making the objection you cut it off. And Doyle continues to say that, well, this was our main point that they were being coached by the government. Well, first of all, the only point made was that the government talked to the witness beforehand, which is allowed, and there's a jury instruction on that. Secondly, there is – I think that's my only point on that. So the case law doesn't allow the inquiry to be cut off. There's nothing cut off. Everything was answered, and they had every opportunity to go on. I'll talk about the vouching question, the Fifth Amendment right to fair trial. There's no case law, again, that says saying very good or fair enough or okay can cause a trial to be unfair. And if you look at the instances when it happened, it was pervasive, and it probably shouldn't have happened. But it was, you know, very good was said when giving an address with David Czar at 702, or with Hellett when he asked her to speak louder, and he said very good. Or fair enough when he said, I think...
As a matter of fact, in trial technique, they teach to not do that only because everybody does it.
Right, and it's something that when you look at a transcript, uh-huh. And when I go back and look at the transcript of this, if there's an or an and or a very good that's put in,
yeah.
You don't want it there. But it's there because it's part
okay,
of the conversation.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So I don't think there's...
Well, you know, we'll never hear it. We'll never know how it was done. We have a cold record. We don't have, you know, but the idea that someone like Judge Herndon, who is such a lovely man, would have become so upset, it must have been pretty unusual.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the full statement of what Judge Herndon said, his anger was directed at the fact that The government was doing was objecting to something that they had done before. He didn't. The judge didn't say anything about it during the time, the days before when these things happened. The judge said, "Look, you're screaming this objection of making a statement when, which he said would be a valid objection, except that you've been doing it all along." So he was angry more at the what he felt was the hypocrisy of the government being angry at something that it was already doing. He didn't object when those statements were made. And the fact is that the jury was not affected by it. The jury actually acquitted him on one count. So the very goods didn't happen. I just think the idea that we were trying to influence a jury by saying very good every once in a while put in is a little subtler than what the government usually does. We just put the evidence out there, and that's what makes sense. I'd also just briefly on the coaching argument. Think before you answer. Listen to the question. Every witness should get that advice. If they're not doing it, they should get advice on the stand. It's no different than saying, please speak into the microphone. It's to make a clear record. It's to make sure that their answers don't adhere to go into areas that you're not supposed to go into. And it's absolutely the best advice you can give to any defendant. It doesn't suggest an answer, which is what coaching is worried about. And I think that... based on that,
maybe it suggests the next answer. Oh well, go ahead.
I just don't think it in and of itself.
It's a signal. It's a signal that this is important. It can be used as a signal that whatever has been happening up to this point is routine, and suddenly something special is going on here. You really need to look out for what's going on.
Right, but it also doesn't suggest that you should say anything in particular. It just allows you to focus in, especially when we're talking about witnesses who are nervous, are talking about embarrassing things about prostitution and their own drug use, and trying to get everything involved. I think it's a tactic. It's used by everyone, and there's never been a case that says that's inappropriate. And I think, unless there are any other questions, we ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've used all your time, but I am going to give you 3 minutes because, Ms. Schmidt, you came a long way. And because we want to hear what you have to say.
So first I'd like to address this point about waiver. Government has argued that we waived our right to challenge Exhibit 95F when we agreed to admit Exhibit 95F along with the rest of Exhibit 95A. But as Mr. Kutry said, when Exhibit 95 and all 9 parts of it were presented, it was presented as to Dr. Birch as this is your report and these are your conclusions. And so as the government presented Exhibit 95A, Exhibit 95B, these were from Dr. Birch. And then at that point, defense counsel said, okay, we have no objection. But that was before Exhibit 95F was discussed at all. And when Dr. Birch was being asked about Exhibit 95F, the government asked him a question about these crossouts and about what Dr. Dutra thought about them. And defense counsel objected, said, objection, Your Honor, Dr. Birch can't testify about what Dr. Dutra thought. And so the government reformulated the question and moved on. And then during cross, it's when it became clear that Dr. Birch had no basis to testify about Exhibit 95F at all. And Exhibit 95F is the only contemporaneous document that documents the autopsy of Jonathan Ward. It's dated on May 30th, 2009, which is the date of the autopsy, and there are handwritten notes of what Dr. Dutcher was observing at that time. And Dr. Birch had no basis to testify about this document. He was not present when Dr. Birch wrote it. And he had no idea when these crossouts are made, why they were made, or even if Dr. Dutra had made them. And so so we established that on cross, but because Dr. Birch did not have any basis to testify about this document, we were entitled to ask Dr. Dutra questions about it. and we were denied that right. And as a result, because this is a testimonial document, despite the government's assertion that this document is not testimonial because it's not an official certification, that proposition was rejected in Melendez-Diaz, where the Supreme Court specifically rejected very formal categories of sworn testimony. They said that's not the only type of testimonial document. And in fact, the test is broader than that. The test is whether or not a defendant would reasonably think that this document would be used against him. And in fact, this document was used against Mr. Doyle to demonstrate that the cause of death was heroin, when in fact this document says heroin and cocaine were potentially the causes of death. And then just briefly on the point regarding the prosecutorial misconduct, I think discussing what went wrong and what Judge Herndon noted individually may not seem like it matters much. But the test must be, you have to look at this conduct cumulatively and the cumulative effect that it had, particularly on count four. Despite the fact that this was a 9-day trial, count four was much more limited, and the government's conduct was particularly egregious during count four.
Let me, before you sit down, let me just ask you, Ms. Schmidt. Yeah, I agree with you. You have to look at this kind of thing cumulatively. The district judge is the person in the best position to be able to evaluate that sort of effect in the first instance. Let me recast the issue and tell me whether this is a fair statement of the issue, which is whether it was plain error for the district judge not to sua sponte grant a mistrial based on the cross-examination and the other things that you all are complaining about. The judge saw it, stepped in, took control of the courtroom, but nobody asked him to declare a mistrial, and I think to reverse on that basis, we would have to say it was so egregious that he should have granted a mistrial on his own.
Your Honor, yes, I think that's parallel to what we're asking here.
Right. Is there any case support remotely comparable to that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but we would be happy to submit some supplemental briefing on it.
Well, that's kind of the central issue, but I don't think we need additional briefs. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. The Court has no further questions. We just ask that you reverse.
Thank you so very much. I want to thank all counsel, of course, but I particularly wish to thank Mr. Kutry and Ms. Schmidt for taking on this difficult case and for doing such a fine job for their client. And I would like to thank the law firm of Kirkland & Ellis as well. And the case will be taken under advisement.